On this week's 51%, an author talks about the feminist revolution. We hear from a transgender Orthodox Jewish professor.
Are we just a problem that has to be dealt with, or do our voices and perspectives enrich religious tradition?
And learn how the VA is handling sexual assault victims. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
To me, the future is female means that no longer will female qualities be subordinated to male qualities. I want to live in a world that is collaborative, a world that is emotionally intelligent, a world in which we are linked and not ranked. The future is female.
The book, The Feminist Revolution, The Struggle for Women's Liberation, begins with the founding of the National Organization for Women in 1966 and traces a path through political campaigns, protests, the formation of women's publishing houses and groundbreaking magazines, and other events that shaped women's history. The anthology demonstrates that the feminist revolution was enacted by women from all backgrounds, of every color, and of all ages, and that it took place in the home, at work, and in the streets. Bonnie Morris and D.M. Withers are the authors of The Feminist Revolution, The Struggle for Women's Liberation, and 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall spoke with Morris about her book, which is a collection of essays, oral histories, and illustrations depicting the global history and contributions of the feminist revolution in the late 20th century.
Why is this the right time to talk about women's lib again?
It's a really wonderful opportunity to provide a pretty coherent history of how everything new is actually old. These movements have been developing in a new generation. But I often find that my own students at Berkeley or other schools where I've taught are unfamiliar with just how radical women in their mother's generation actually were. And they're probably unfamiliar with the range of actions, meetings, rallies, and manifesta that were put together before we had an internet to connect everybody.
Do you think with all of the news that's going on, all the headlines about women's issues, do you think that in society there's kind of a backward momentum that we're, you know, maybe undoing some of the things that these women did in this movement?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's certainly not the fault of committed feminist activists. There's been a horrible backlash against reproductive rights in ways I don't think anyone could foresee. There was so much success in promoting better women's health care, access to contraception, funding for poor women to get better sex education and medical services, and of course, abortion rights. And there was a lot of assumption that in the 70s that had been a victory that wouldn't be disturbed. So there's been a lot of organized conservative momentum to undo issues around women's control of her own body. Another thing that's a big issue, of course, is we're suddenly discovering that sexual harassment has not ended. And in fact, we simply have better megaphones to address it. We're empowered to call out perpetrators on social media and in blogs. And the more, of course, that Hollywood women have taken the lead there, that's great. But that is a group that's empowered financially and in many other ways. So for poor women who are very much at risk if they call out an employer and then are out of work, it's much more of a brave gesture to get involved with trying to change what we call workplace culture. And then something else that I think is significant is the fact that we have sexual violence that occurs on the college campus and in intimate relationships that really hasn't been vanquished, which suggests we have not succeeded in educating young men about respect, the consequences of the law, let alone the morally right way to treat a partner. One thing that I find my students suggesting is that women having power equals feminism has been won and we move on. I've surveyed quite a few students who will equate rich and powerful women with feminist leadership. That's not really the same thing, but I think we have made it seem as though where women have moved into positions in the military and certainly in sports and business and law, that means that everyone's work is done here, and it's not so. The challenge for our next generation is to continue feminist action, but in a different sort of identity. I think it's natural to want to make your feminism different from that of your parents' generation, but the issues are the same. They really are the same.
Now, you say that they're the same. There's also the differences that we see in just having today's society be sort of the backdrop for everything.
Yeah.
So how did that affect the voices that you collected for this sort of feminist anthology? How did you put that all together to speak to today's audience?
What was sort of in mind was to begin with the awakening of many women who had been isolated from one another, but who could respond to a number of issues that became better known through public activism. The layout of the book sort of proceeded from, you know, old slogan, the personal is political, to how women became more involved in political representation to try and change some of the ridiculous laws that kept them out or treated them as second-class citizens. Then almost immediately, we wanted Chapter 3 to look at the very different issues for women of color, the ways the movement was divided racially or incomplete in its inclusivity, and what were the priorities for black women in the movement, who were certainly there in large numbers. And so a lot of the book is about what's been called do-it-yourself culture, or the women's culture that emerged to serve a consumer base that was newly awakened, and there was a good deal of awareness that women's culture should be accessible. It should be, for instance, sliding scale for low-income women at events. There should be childcare at events. There should be accessibility for women with disabilities. There should be, in short, a wheelchair ramp, a sign language interpreter, and all the ways that the range of women in the United States and beyond could be involved.
I do want to ask, though, too, are there any particular women that you cite? I know Shirley Chisholm is mentioned in the book. And any other particular voices that you think would resonate, especially resonate with today's audiences?
For one thing, I teach a class on women's sports history, so I'm all about educating today's young female athletes and male athletes about Title IX law, and I think it's really important that everyone understand that the right for girls to play better-funded sports was advanced by Representative Patsy Mink, the first Asian-American woman in Congress, and she pushed for Title IX law. She's somebody I think it's very important to know about.
Who do you envision picking up this book, and what do you want them to take away from it?
Well, it's intended to resonate with women who are veterans of the movement and their daughters. It is very much intended to be a multi-generational guide. What happened? What did it look like? If for someone who was there, it will affirm some of the more important turning points, famous rallies, great performances, and figures of a movement that is still going on. And I would say it's also useful for anybody who is archiving aspects of feminism. What do you want to save? I'm very interested in this question. I want to say to every woman within range of my voice, what are you going to do with your stuff? Where are you leaving your scrapbooks, your photos, your pins, you know, your shirt that has a slogan on it? So many of the terrific slogans of that era were circulated on bumper stickers and pins and T-shirts. One of the most famous was, "A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle," and many others. But it's important, I think, that the book be seen as a reminder that the era you live through should be marked with your experience, your participation, and saving souvenirs from events that spoke to one personally is a great habit that can later make everyone into a little mini historian. So the way the book is laid out, I hope, will excite young women and older women to think about how they might tell the story of their participation in feminism.
That was Bonnie Morris, author of The Feminist Revolution, The Struggle for Women's Liberation, published by Smithsonian Books. She was speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Morris taught women's history for 22 years at both George Washington University and Georgetown University, and is now a lecturer in the Gender and Women's Studies Department at UC Berkeley. The Pentagon says about 15,000 service members have experienced some kind of sexual trauma while in uniform, but because of the stigma, many wait decades before they seek help. Bobby O'Brien visited a special unit at a VA hospital in Florida. There, survivors of military sexual trauma receive intense inpatient treatment.
Living with a sexual trauma is tough enough, but when it happens in the military, there's an increased level of power and control, according to VA psychologist Jessica Keith.
Often the perpetrators are someone in the command line, someone who has more power, and power not only to ruin someone's career, we also have to remember these are people with weapons who are trained to use them, so it can be terrifying when you're sexually traumatized in the military.
Keith manages the Bay Pines VA Center for Sexual Trauma. Their residential co-ed program treats veterans who have severe PTSD because they were sexually assaulted or harassed, which can be especially traumatic if the perpetrator is a fellow service member.
If they're in your unit, you're told that these are your brothers and sisters. This is your family, that they're supposed to have your back. So what does it mean when somebody who's supposed to have your back is the same person who sexually assaults you? It really increases the severity of the trauma on that person.
So restoring trust is part of the treatment. Survivor Jackie Thorington, an Army veteran, says she felt betrayed and ashamed when her military superior assaulted her decades ago. Thorington entered the Bay Pines residential program in January because her outpatient therapy sessions weren't helping.
I needed specialized care, and I knew that things were really going wrong. I was very depressed. I was suicidal. I couldn't function at work anymore. I really thought that my world was done, that I was going to kill myself.
At Bay Pines, she meets with a therapist twice a week for prolonged exposure therapy, where she tells the story of her assault over and over until the strong fear associated with the memory decreases. 7 days a week, she's in a group session with the other 15 women and men in the program, and they often go on field trips to be exposed to real-life situations like a crowded mall. After just a few weeks, Thorington felt a difference.
My life's given back to me again. I'm 53 years old. I don't have another 53 to go, you know, maybe, but what I do have left, I want to enjoy it and not be looking over my shoulder anymore.
The program is designed to reintegrate veterans back into their communities, their work, and their personal relationships. It treats about 100 veterans a year in the residential program and another 400 as outpatients. Dr. Alfonso Corina is chief of mental health at Bay Pines. He says he's seen veterans become more open about sexual trauma during his 17 years there.
So now we have more males that are really coming forward and being assessed for military sexual trauma, which in the past, it was a no-no in the military to kind of share those experiences.
He says the program has changed as well during that time. It's more open to trying different treatments when evidence-based care doesn't work. Keith says it's all about letting veterans set their own goals.
We ask them, what do they want to see different in their life? For some veteran, it might be straightforward. They want fewer nightmares. They want less PTSD symptoms. But others want something very different. They say,
I want a date.
Yeah, I want to be in a relationship, finally. Whatever it is for them, that's what we work on.
Bay Pines was the VA's first residential program to treat both men and women and remains one of only a handful. But every VA medical center now has a military sexual trauma coordinator. I'm Bobby O'Brien in St. Petersburg.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. A trailblazing transgender Orthodox Jewish professor recently spoke at Williams College in Massachusetts. 51%'s Josh Landes reports.
Professor Joy Layden finds herself at the intersection of two identities.
Both trans and Jewish identity are constantly multiplying and taking new forms.
Layden is the author of 10 books, 9 books of poetry, a mother of 3, and has been the David and Ruth Gottesman Chair in English at Stern College of Yeshiva University since 2003. After receiving tenure in 2007, Layden came out as transgender to the college, which, unable to fire her, briefly barred her from campus. A chorus of support from students and a letter from Layden's lawyers led to her return in 2008. She is thought to be the first and only publicly transgender person employed by an Orthodox Jewish institution.
Both in the LGBTQ world and in the traditional religious world, there's a sense that trans identities, like other LGBTQ identities, are kind of inherently secular because they've become visible and validated and represented first in secular cultures and have been much less visible in traditional religious culture.
Layden explores how the trans and Jewish identities interact with each other.
Are we just a problem that has to be dealt with, or do our voices and perspectives enrich religious tradition? Or do we just kind of come from outside it and make things a little harder than they should be?
Rabbi Seth Wax is the Jewish chaplain of Williams College.
She is professor of English and is really a cutting-edge figure in Jewish life and writing, particularly speaking from a trans perspective, and is a really important voice in LGBTQ inclusion in Jewish community.
Wax invited Layden to speak at Williams.
She spoke about the concept of the hyper-minority and how trans folks, like other people who are minorities, can feel a sense of being multiple levels of minority depending on the community that you live in. And she saw God feels a similar thing in the descriptions of God in the Hebrew Bible, that God wants to be in relationship with the Jewish people, with people in the world in general, but there's a lot of difficulties around that. And the people don't necessarily understand God, don't know how to relate to God, and continually turn away from or disappoint God. And that feeling of aloneness that she saw, or she read God feeling in the Bible, was something that she felt herself.
Molly Barenbaum is a Williams freshman from Denver who attended the talk.
As someone who's Jewish, I think it was really fascinating and very important to hear from someone in this, you know, position within our community and who's working to expand, and not just tolerance, but acceptance and sort of open arms welcoming of LGBT people and other people who don't fit the mold in whatever way within the Jewish community. I think that's really important.
There's a wonderful organization called Keshet, based in Boston, New York, Colorado, and San Francisco, that advocates for the full inclusion of LGBTQ individuals in the Jewish community.
Rabbi Wax.
We have so much to learn from people who identify as LGBTQ. There's so much richness that's yet to be unpacked in the Jewish tradition and our religious lives that losing people who identify in this way would be a real loss for the Jewish community and for our collective understanding of God, of each other, and of who we are.
Again, Professor Layden.
The fact that we can't, no matter how hard we try, do anything but be who we are, that is kind of a religious experience in and of itself. You know, when you come up against the parts of yourself that no matter how convenient or good it would be, you just can't change. That's really you. That's the way you're made. And if you're a religious person, in the way that you were made, you see the hand of God.
For 51%, I'm Josh Landes.
In a New York City suburb, there's a new law to help close the gender wage gap. The Westchester County Executive signed the measure on Equal Pay Day, which was April 10th. And the day before, the county's Board of Legislators unanimously approved the provision. And Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says he is advancing similar legislation. Democratic Westchester County Executive George Latimer signed a law that bans businesses from asking about a job seeker's salary history in the application or during an interview.
It's 2018. It's time now for everybody to be treated, every job applicant to be treated equally.
That's Democratic County Legislator Catherine Borgia, the bill's primary sponsor. She says the legislation goes beyond closing the gender wage gap.
Anecdotally, we've heard a lot about older workers, that it really helps older workers as well, because for the opposite reason of sometimes they're getting priced out of a job market when they need a job after they've been let go from a higher paying job. So it really is something that just levels the playing field in a way that I just think it's a much cleaner transaction between employer and prospective employee. Everyone can negotiate to the best of their ability.
County Legislator Margaret Cunzio, a conservative, says it is important for such a provision to be replicated elsewhere.
It should be about fairness. It shouldn't be about gender. It shouldn't be about age. It shouldn't be about ethnicity. It should be strictly about qualifications, looking for the quality of the person for the job, and really looking for leveling the playing field. And if you're applying for a job, you really should be viewed at for fairness.
In fact, Governor Cuomo Tuesday advanced legislation to prohibit all employers, public and private, who do business in New York from asking prospective employees about their salary history and compensation. This was a chief recommendation from a State Department of Labor report entitled Closing the Gender Wage Gap in New York State. In New York, women earn the equivalent of 89 cents to each dollar earned by men, the narrowest wage gap of any state in the nation and higher than the national average of 80 cents. However, Black or African American women are paid the equivalent of 64 cents on the dollar, and Hispanic and Latina women are paid 55 cents on the dollar. Meanwhile, the Westchester legislators point to a study by the American Association of University Women in 2013 that found women get paid 6.6% less than men in their first jobs, and the inequity is perpetuated. Again, Cunzio.
And I did some investigative work based on my previous career, which was in education, looking at the leadership of school districts in Westchester County. And what we found was very interesting was that there were a lot more men in these positions. They make more money, and that includes the years of experience that they had. And it was eye-opening to me because when you go in a lot of times for an interview, a lot of times they will ask, well, what were you making? And they work from there, as opposed to having an open and fair, and it's really what we wanted was an open and fair playing field for someone to be able to interview and be hired based on their qualifications, not based on pigeonholed, their gender and saying, oh, well, because it's a male, female, we can offer X number or Y number of dollars.
Catherine Borgia.
Women start out their careers being paid a little bit less than men. And if every salary is based on the salary that came before, obviously that gap is going to grow exponentially for women and people of color. So it's an economic move. It helps everyone. It helps all of Westchester families.
Similar measures are already on the books in New York City and in several states. And Governor Cuomo says New York's fiscal year 2019 budget contains legislation that helps to ensure equal access to diaper changing stations and restrooms. So changing tables will be available to women and men. The legislation also provides lactation rooms in state buildings that are open to the public. These efforts stem from the governor's 2018 Women's Agenda. Democratic State Assembly member Dee Dee Barrett applauds the requirement for lactation rooms in state buildings, saying it is overdue. As for equal access to changing stations,
you know, that's a really key piece, is that having changing tables for dads and for men as well. I mean, having had a son and a daughter, and you know, the awkwardness of, you know, of taking your toddlers or your, you know, infants into single gender bathrooms and having to deal with that is always something that we're like, when are we going to move beyond this? And so I think this is great policy.
The budget also directs the Department of State to study the feasibility of installing changing facilities in public buildings. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1500.